Well, let me say a really good evening and welcome to Euston Church. My name's Ed. I'm the assistant minister here. And it's a real pleasure as well to be able to welcome Andrew Satch. He's going to be speaking for us this evening. Andrew is the minister of Grace Church in Greenwich and is a real friend of ours here at Euston. And he's also the author of several books, including this one, which is our topic for this evening. Are you 100% sure you want to be an agnostic? So if you're here for that, you're in the right place. Well done. Andrew's going to come and speak to us in a second. He'll speak for about 40 minutes or so. And then what will happen is we'll have a break for 5 minutes. And that will be a chance for you to ask any questions that you'd like to, and you could submit that, here we go, via Pigeonhole, so pigeonhole.at, enter that password, ask your question, and you'll be able to put your questions onto the Pigeonhole, and they'll come up on the screen when we have our question time. So that slide will come back on the screen in that five-minute break later on. And then after those 5 minutes, I'll put those questions to Andrew for 20 minutes, and then we'll finish, and you feel free to enjoy some more nibbles after that. So without further ado, let me invite Andrew up.
Hello, and thank you for the invitation to be here this evening to talk about agnosticism, and which is all really about saying, I don't know, and I prefer to sit on the fence. This particular poster is a bit subliminal. It's just a fence, but you have to imagine yourself placed on that fence and decide how you'd feel about it. Better not to be dogmatic. No one likes a crazed fanatic. Here's a girl who's got her wits on the fence. That's where she sits, saying no one's right or wrong. Maybe, baby. That's the chorus of the cool agnostic song. Buddha, Vishnu, I don't care. Who's to say what God is there? I love Man U, she loves Spurs. I've got my truth, she's got hers. We don't need to disagree. Maybe, baby, that's what I say to your Christianity. That's not an actual song, it's just a poem that I made up. But it is the creed of the agnostic to say maybe, to sit on the fence. I mean, that's what agnosticism means. The word comes from the Greek word gnosis, which means knowledge. And you put an A in front of it and it means not knowledge. So just like you could call a vegetarian an A carnivore. Or you could call someone who despises bagpipes a Scottish. If Gnosticism is about knowing, then agnosticism is about not knowing. It just means, I don't know. Yeah, maybe. Haven't made up my mind. Did Jesus rise from the dead? Maybe. Is there a heaven and a hell? Maybe. And it just seems very reasonable, doesn't it, in our day and age, to admit to ignorance. It's better than being dogmatic. When people are too dogmatic, then they get arrogant, don't they? They say, I'm right and everyone else is wrong. That's not very attractive. Or worse than that, not only are they arrogant, but they get arrogant and they get violent. I'm right and I'm going to shoot everyone else who's wrong. Wouldn't the world be a happier place if we all just agree to disagree and we say that we don't know? I think that's the appeal of agnosticism in our culture. And I want to explore it. And before I get into it, I want to talk about three different types of agnosticism. This isn't an official sort of philosophical classifications. These are just my three ways of thinking about it. But I think you'll agree there are different ways that you could be agnostic about something. So you could be agnostic because something is knowable in principle, but you just don't know because you've never checked. So I could say, for example, I'm agnostic about how many helium balloons I would need to attach to my mother to send her into orbit. I mean, you know, I've never done the experiment. Now, it'd be possible to know. It'd be fairly easy, wouldn't it? You just attach one balloon, no, a second, a third, a fourth, until the moment that she takes off, and then that's your answer. And there's lots of questions like that. There's questions that science could probe, but we just haven't got round to asking yet. And it might be that you're agnostic about God in that way. It would be possible to know about him. For example, you could, on the way out today, you could get one of these little books, which is a first century eyewitness document about Jesus, written by one of his disciples. And if you've never read anything like this before, I would say it's not surprising that you're agnostic. You've never looked at any of the evidence. Why not look at some of it? So on your way out today, grab one of these, have a read, and you'll be a little bit more informed about Christianity and what you think of it. Who was Jesus? Well, I don't know. Let's find out what some of his contemporaries thought. So you could be agnostic just because you haven't bothered to check, so why not check? But there's another way of being agnostic that's a bit more principled than that. And this person is not so much saying, I don't know, as I can't know. It wouldn't be possible to know, certainly, whether or not there's a God. But there's an irony about it when you think about it, because that kind of agnostic isn't actually very agnostic about their own agnosticism. They're kind of saying, I am dogmatically sure that I cannot be sure. And that's a little bit ironic. I want to say to them, what makes you so sure that you can't be sure? If you think about it for a minute, actually, it's very hard to prove a negative, to say, I know that there's not enough evidence for God. I mean, how would you know that? You'd have to have first researched everything. What if there was some evidence that you'd missed? It would be like saying, I know that there's no treasure hidden in Leicestershire. I mean, how could you know that? What if there was a diamond necklace hidden in a detergent bottle at a postcode that the police have yet to raid? What if there was a gold nugget buried beneath an inconspicuous cabbage field? The University of Leicester Archaeological Services, who, let's face it, do more digging than the rest of us, didn't even know until recently that the bones of the English King Richard III were underneath their local car park. How could you know that the evidence wasn't there unless you're claiming to know everything? I think that sort of absolute agnosticism is just a bit silly and a bit philosophically incoherent. Now, because this is Bloomsbury and some of you are studying at UCL and some of you are very clever, some of you are thinking, oh, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle or Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And if you know about either of those enough to know what they actually are, you'll know these don't really impinge on questions of God's existence or what we're doing here in this world. So two kinds so far. There's I don't know because I haven't checked. Why not check? There's I don't know because you can't know. Don't be so ridiculous. This is not a philosophically sensible position. But then there's a third kind, and I think actually this is the most common kind. It's not so much I don't know as I don't want to know. Just would you leave me alone, please, annoying Christian. Now, if you're here tonight, they haven't left you alone, and you've been kind enough to humour them and come, and I appreciate your time for this evening. But I think for a lot of people, agnosticism appeals not because they don't think Christianity is true, but because of a fear that if it was true, it would be a drag. It would wreck our lives. Certainly that's what I used to think. I tried to keep Christians at arm's length because I believed the fake news that if Christianity had a colour, it would be grey. If you could sum up the Christian ethic in a word, it would be don't. If you can imagine a Christian having fun, that would be sitting down on a Saturday night to watch back-to-back episodes of Songs of Praise. If you don't know what that is, then you're missing out. And I just kind of think, one of my friends described a Christian party as drinking schlur, which they said was Christian champagne. Actually, a friend of mine said that he was really surprised when he read about Jesus' first miracle that's recorded in this book. I hope you will take one of these at the end. The first miracle of Jesus recorded here is of Jesus turning water into wine. And he said he found this very surprising. It wasn't so much the unusual chemistry that surprised him. And, you know, sure, you can't do H2O to H5OH in a laboratory. And that's just turning it into alcohol, let alone the tannins and anthocyanins and flavanols and all the different complex wine chemistry. I mean, you can't do that in a laboratory, but he thought, yeah, sure, but if Jesus made the universe, it wouldn't be too difficult for him to do some unusual chemistry. He said the thing that surprised him was that Jesus wasn't instead going around the world turning all the wine into water. You know, because wasn't God's greatest fear meant to be that people might be enjoying themselves a bit too much? And he had to stamp it out. And I want to say at the beginning tonight, this just isn't the Jesus that you discover in the pages of this book. This isn't the Jesus that you find in history. He's not the killjoy Jesus. You find here a Jesus who wants parties to go well. And when's the last time you were at a party and someone said, oh, this is really not got much of a buzz, this. I wish there were more Christians here. You know, it's not the stereotype, is it? But Jesus made parties go better. Jesus thought sex was good because as the creator of the universe, he invented sex. You know, that's why we can do it, because of parts of our bodies that have nerve cells and fit together with other parts of other people's bodies and so on. Now, you know, the Bible is against the abuse of sex. And I only have to say the names Jimmy Savile and Harvey Weinstein for us to know that not all sex is good. Sex can harm people. And the Bible's against abusing alcohol. And a close friend of mine died of alcohol poisoning. And alcohol cannot be so fun. But, you know, in its right context, Jesus couldn't be more pro-joy and relationship and sex and parties. And so if you're keeping Christianity at arm's length for a fear that it might not be good, can I urge you to have another look? So, okay, so let's say you're not agnostic in the sense number two, I can't know. Maybe I'm persuading you to not be so sure that you want to be agnostic in sense three, I don't want to know. You're just agnostic in sense one. Like, what's the information? Like, is it possible to know? So hit me, you know, tell me something to convince me. Well, I want to have a look in the time we've got remaining. A little excerpt from the New Testament, so from the Bible. It's some words written by John, who is the same bloke who wrote this. So this is his biography of Jesus' life. And then this is just two paragraphs from a letter that he wrote to some Christian friends. So we're going to look at the letter, but I want you to look at the biography if you'd like to take one as you go out. But I just want to read a few words, and I'm going to make a few comments from it, and then I'm going to stop talking, and you can ask questions. So I'm going to read it first, and then I'll explain why this is a very extraordinary paragraph that I've read. That which was from the beginning, which we've heard, which we've seen with our eyes, which we looked upon and have touched with our hands concerning the word of life. The life was made manifest. We've seen it. We testify to it. We proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and was made manifest to us. That which we've seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you too may have fellowship with us. Indeed, our fellowship is with the Father, that's God the Father, and with his Son, Jesus Christ. And we're writing these things to suck all of the joy out of your life. No, he doesn't say that. We're writing these things so that our joy may be complete. Now, maybe it just sounds to you like something religious that you'd expect to be in the Bible. I want to suggest this is actually a very extraordinary paragraph, because it combines two things that by themselves are quite normal, but never ever get combined. So on the one hand, it's a paragraph about philosophy. You know, the biggest possible questions. What is life? It's about the life. And people talk about that sort of thing all the time, especially in modern art galleries. I don't know whether you're a fan of them. I love going to modern art galleries. My favourite one is the White Cube Gallery in Bermondsey. And recently they had an exhibition by Anthony Gormley, who I think is amazing, the sculptor. But a few years ago, I go quite regularly, a few years ago they had an exhibition by Peter Dreyer, the German artist. And in the exhibition were 350 paintings, each one measuring 8 inches by 10 inches, and every painting was of the same empty glass of water. And you're thinking, like, why? But they were really good paintings. I mean, it's actually quite difficult to paint a glass of water because the refraction of the light through the glass and then the way that the shadows catch it. And, you know, it's quite impressive. And he, each morning, would get up, you know, for 10 years. And you can imagine his wife saying to him, well, what are you going to do today, Peter? Oh, I thought I might just, you know, paint a glass of water and then see what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. And he just, again and again, and they were all there in the gallery at the same time. So it's kind of an interesting thing. And you're like, why? And then you get the notes that the gallery gives you that go along with the exhibition. And then in this particular case, the note said, Peter Dreyer reveals that there can be great fullness even in an empty glass. He thought, you're quite pleased with that, aren't you? Now, people discussing philosophy, you know, what is fullness, what is emptiness, what is life, what is eternity, what is a human being, what is male, what is female, what is truth? You know, people do that in modern art. It's often a kind of hand-wavy, philosophizing, mystical. You can't really kind of nail it down, but people are interested in that stuff. That's not especially unusual. Let's go to the other extreme, a very different kind of genre of literature. I went on my stepbrother's Facebook page a few years ago, and on that particular day, he said, went to the Stag and Lantern, good pint. Now, my stepbrother lives in Hyams Park on the Victoria Line, and the Stag and Lantern is a microbrewery, and he went there and he thought it was a good pint. He's into IPAs. And, you know, that's kind of normal. You know, every day a billion people upload that sort of information about their lives onto Facebook or Instagram or TikTok or whatever. So maybe you tweet, went to a talk in a church with a high ceiling with a bald bloke talking about agnosticism. I mean, you know, if tonight was significant enough for you to tweet that, please do. Now, that's normal, right? So philosophizing is normal. What is truth? What is ultimate reality? And talking about what happened to you is normal. Went to an evening at a church with my Christian friend. But they're very different kinds of literature, and they don't really go together. So, for example, you would never read somebody saying, you'll never guess who walked into the Stag and Lantern on Tuesday night. Who? Life did. Like, what? I mean, it just sounds weird, doesn't it? And that's what John is saying here. That which was from the beginning. So, you know, the origin of the universe, the beginning of everything, which we heard. Like, what on earth do you mean? What, you heard the Big Bang? Don't think so. Which we've seen with our eyes. How can you have seen the beginning, John? Are you mad? We've looked upon, we've touched with our hands concerning the word of life, the life. The life was manifest, and we've seen it. Now, what's going on here, and I guess you probably guessed this by now, he's talking about Jesus, this friend of his, this guy that he spent 3 years with, that he went on trips with in him and his brother's fishing boat, that he travelled around the country with. And he's saying, a bloke that I met is the answer to the biggest philosophical questions of human existence. You know, the life is a person. The beginning of everything is a person. The answer to philosophy is a person. A person that I know quite well, he says. So I'm writing to you about him. Now, this is a pretty extraordinary claim, right? Because he's saying that he's met somebody who he thinks holds the key to all reality. Now, I've been speaking now for, let me just check so I don't go on forever. When did we start? 20:30. I've been speaking about 20 minutes. I said I'd speak for 40 minutes. I'm halfway through. 20 minutes in is already long enough for you to have concluded quite firmly that I am not God. I think. Is that right? Anyone think, oh, wow, you know, we're fortunate this evening. We've got the creator of the universe. No, I don't think so. You're thinking, you know, he's an average bloke with receding hair. He's saying some moderately interesting things, maybe, if I'm being flattering to myself. But can you imagine spending not 20 minutes with me, but 3 years with me? Maybe you're sitting next to somebody that you've known for 3 years. Are you even remotely tempted to believe that they are the life, the beginning? I mean, like, obviously not, right? They're just another flawed human being with good days and bad days. So this is the question I want you to be curious enough about. What is it about Jesus that convinces his best mate that he has met life itself? And I suggest Jesus must have done some pretty unusual and convincing things. I mean, unless John is gullible, that's an option, I suppose. But you could check, couldn't you? So, as I say, please take one of these. This is a full-length biography of Jesus written by the same bloke, by John. who knew Jesus personally, about why he thinks that Jesus is the life. Now, you might disagree with him. You might think that he drew the wrong conclusions, but have a look at the evidence and see what you think. Sometimes people say you shouldn't trust books about, you shouldn't trust the Bible because it's written by Christians, so it's biased. And sometimes I reply cheekily, you shouldn't trust books about medicine because they're written by doctors and they're biased. I mean, you know, doctors do believe in medicine, and John does believe in Jesus, but that doesn't mean he's lying. It just, you know, he's committed to the thing that he's sharing with us, but you've got to decide, did he have good reasons for that? What are the sorts of things that he saw Jesus do, he heard Jesus say, that convinced him that Jesus was life? Because this is the interesting thing. John and some of Jesus' other followers, they weren't agnostic. Sometimes people say to me as a Christian, you know, you say that you believe in God, but how sure are you? You know, like, are you 60% sure? Are you sort of 80% sure? I think if you ask John, he'd say, I'm 100% sure. John, why are you so sure? He said, well, because of what I saw and heard and touched. I want to give you one example. There's all sorts of amazing things that Jesus does in front of eyewitnesses in this book. One of my favorite ones that I'm not going to have time to talk about tonight is when Jesus, well, I'm going to talk about it now, but I'm saying I haven't got time to talk about it properly tonight, is when Jesus heals a man who was blind from birth so that he can see. And this is a very objective kind of thing to do, and I want to suggest it's quite difficult to fake it because, you know, this guy has been blind from birth, so everyone in the town knows him as the blind man, and then he can see. So I'm as skeptical as the next person about some of these signs and wonders, miracle crusades. You think, isn't this just a Christian faking something to try and get funding? And in some cases, I think that's true. You know, there was some awful case in the news recently of a exploitative preacher in Africa who had loads of people following him. So, you can fake miracles. People do that. But it's kind of difficult to fake this kind of miracle. You know, like, excuse me, do you mind pretending to be blind for, like, your entire life, and then I'll come along in 20, 30 years' time and I'll heal you? Okay, sure. I mean, how do you do that? Where everyone knows the guy's blind, and then afterwards the guy's not blind. And this is a very objective piece of data. And then the skeptics, they investigate it. They check it out. You can read about it in chapter 9 of this book. You can look at their full-scale attempt to debunk the miracle and see what they discover. That's one of my favourites. But I think John has got another one in mind here. He says, that which was from the beginning, which we've heard, which we've seen with our eyes, which we looked upon and have touched with our hands concerning the word of life. I think he is referencing here one of the most famous episodes in his eyewitness biography of Jesus, known as the encounter with doubting Thomas. You may have heard of that phrase before. For the purposes of tonight's talk, I'm going to call him Agnostic Thomas. What happens, basically, is Jesus dies. He's executed by the Romans on a cross, by crucifixion. And then 3 days later, people start to say that they've seen Jesus alive again. Jesus himself had predicted that he'd be killed and then he'd be raised from the dead. But a lot of people found that quite difficult to believe. Maybe, you know, they had scientific understanding of death and it's irreversible. Maybe they thought, this, you know, we like Jesus, but you know, he didn't really work in the end and the authorities caught up with him and they killed him. But some people started saying, no, Jesus, genuinely, he's back from the dead and we've seen him. And Thomas, agnostic Thomas, he says famously, I can't believe that without more evidence. In order to believe that Jesus had risen from the dead, I'd have to see him myself, and I'd have to examine the places where they put the holes in his hands, so where they nailed his hands in the crucifixion, and I want to look at his side, where the centurion speared his side to check that he was dead. And Jesus appears to Thomas and says, here I am, touch me and see. Perform the examination that you want to. I talked already about modern art, Peter Dreyer. Let's talk about Renaissance art or older art. Caravaggio, the painting, one of my favourite paintings. It's called The Incredulity of St. Thomas. It's painted in 1601. And it shows this man Thomas, examining Jesus. And I love it because a lot of religious art is a bit floaty and unreal. So, you know, Jesus has a halo. He looks like he's not entirely, he's slightly translucent and he doesn't look like a real bloke. But in this painting, I really like it. It's very physical. Here is a man, an old man, opening up a scar, a wound, and looking inside. It's actually quite a gory painting. And I love that because it just captures this, I want actual evidence. If you want me to believe that there's life after death, I need evidence. I want to know that the person in front of me is the same as the person that was dead. It's quite a good test, actually, when you think about it, because by touching Jesus, he can check that he's really alive. You know, it's not just some sort of hologram. But by touching the execution scars, he can check that the person who is alive is the same as the person who used to be dead. So he's kind of verifying death and resurrection in one go. And he checks, and he concludes, really the only possible conclusion, my Lord and my God. There has to be real life. You know, this world can't just be a materialistic one. In a materialistic world, this man could not have come back from the dead. This world cannot be a meaningless one. In a meaningless world, there couldn't be a God such as I have seen do this. So John, he's not agnostic. You see, he's sure. Now, you might say, well, I wasn't there. You know, Jesus hasn't appeared to me for me to check. Sure, and, you know, we have to follow eyewitness evidence. Actually, we live in a country where eyewitness evidence is enough to convict somebody of murder and put them away or exonerate them and let them go free. I mean, you've got to check people aren't lying. There's ways of checking witnesses and their reliability. But in principle, what other people tell you can be reliable, as long as the people who tell you it don't have something to gain. As long as the people who are telling you it are willing to stake something on the credibility of their account. And again, I love this about the early Christians. John, he doesn't become rich. He doesn't become sort of archbishop of somewhere and live in a big palace. He's a fisherman who at the end of his life is exiled for his faith and has to live out his life on a little island. Other early Christians were flogged, ordered not to speak any more about Jesus. The Roman authorities were very nervous, and the Jewish authorities, about what these Christians were saying. They were threatened. Some of them were executed. They didn't have a lot in it for them to sort of make it up. Now, this is the thing about lies. People do die for things that aren't true. I mean, tragically, people give their life in the service of terrible ideologies and cults. For example, I don't think it's true that if you fly an aeroplane into the Twin Towers in Manhattan, you're going to go to paradise. I think that's a lie. But the people who did it thought it was true, presumably. That's what motivated them. So people give their life for causes that they believe in, but people do not give their life for causes that they know to be untrue. And the thing for me about the eyewitnesses of Jesus is the same people who risk their life for it are the people in a position to know. Because John said, I'm telling you about what I saw, what I heard, what I touched with my own hands. And he's saying this isn't going to wreck your life, it's going to be the key to your joy and my joy. We're writing these things so that our joy may be complete. Now, I'm suggesting, therefore, that this bloke John discovered in his encounters with Jesus sufficient evidence to make him sure that he had met life itself, that this was the key to joy, that this is true. And, you know, why not have a look? I think you'd need quite a good reason not to have a look tonight, unless you're just going to, you know, prefer deliberate ignorance to the possibility of knowledge. I'm not saying you have to take my word for it. I'm not even saying you have to believe everything John says. I'm saying you should engage with it and see.
But I want to say one final thing, and then I'm going to stop, and then questions. And the last thing is that not only do you not have to be agnostic, the truth is a person, he's knowable, checkable, but also it's not ultimately safe to be agnostic, that the fence is not as comfortable a place to sit as some people think. And I want to look at the second paragraph more briefly. This is the message we have heard from him and proclaimed to you. Again, he's about to summarize the Christian message in 11 words. If you think I've waffled on too long and should be a bit more concise, this is about as concise as you can get. The whole Christian message condensed down to 11 words. God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. When you think about it for a minute, it's saying something quite profound about God. He's actually disagreeing with all of the Eastern religions in the world. So the Eastern religions think that ultimately there's only one reality to which everything's part of. In Hinduism, in Buddhism, that's the idea that the yin-yang symbol in some Eastern religions is symbolizing exactly that. You know, the yin-yang, the black swirls into the white, the dot of white and the black, the dot of black and the white. It's saying everything is one, really. Good and evil, they're two sides of the same coin. Good and bad, truth and lies. And John says, no, here's the message we told you. God is only light and no darkness. God is only good and no evil. God is only true and no lies. Now, of course, this world's very mixed. In this world, there's good and evil. You look at the news today, there'll be some good things and some evil things. There'll be some true things and some lies in the news today. But God is only truth, only light. And that's a problem when God meets us. If we say we have fellowship or friendship with God while we walk in the darkness, we lie and don't practice the truth. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his son, cleanses us from all sin. I used to live in a house in Stepney Green in East London where the bathroom was in the middle of the house and had no windows. And just the way that the floor plan was designed. And not only did it have no windows, but it had one of those energy-saving light bulbs. Like, we're talking before LEDs, the old fluorescent ones, you know. So you turn the light on, and then it's basically still dark. And after about 5 minutes, it's almost dark. You know, it just gradually glows slightly warmer. And I loved that bathroom because, let me tell you, I looked amazing. You know, in that very soft, dim lighting. I can never understand why people would install sort of thousands of lumens of light in their bathroom so you can see every blackhead and your coffee-yellowed teeth. I mean, in the shadows, most of us look half decent, although some of you look quite sinister, to be honest. But in the light, it's kind of exposing, right? You see the spot, you see the people go for teeth whitening or whatever. And morally in the light, if God is only good and no evil in him, he's kind of awkward to be around. He shows us up. You can hang out with other people who are morally mixed like you are. It's kind of comforting. You say, well, at least I'm better than her, or I'm at least as good as him. But one of the reasons people found Jesus so awkward is he kind of never did anything wrong. He showed them up. And John says that that's a problem, actually. If God's in the light and we're in the darkness and we say that we're friends, we're just deceiving ourselves. There's a problem. But there is a solution to the problem. If we come into the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his son, cleanses us from all sin. The Christian message, it's about God being knowable because he's showed up. The truth has become a person. The life has been seen and touched. But this person who showed up actually sorts out the problem with God, because he cleans us in the way that we're morally dirty so that we can come into the light. Now, in other words, the Christian message is that there's a problem, but there's a solution, simply. Now, I want to give an analogy for this, and it's actually an analogy that Jesus uses elsewhere, a medical analogy. He says there's a problem. It's like a sickness, a very serious one, a sickness that can kill you, a moral sickness. And he said, before that sickness, we need a doctor. And Jesus says, he is the doctor. It's the same thing. It's a problem. There's a solution. But I think it helps us with this question of agnosticism. Imagine on your way home today, your vision goes a bit blurry, in particular around the periphery. You can see your hand here, but you move it over there, and you can't see it anymore. It's a bit scary. And you think, I better go and see a doctor. You go and see the GP. They immediately book you a appointment with a neurologist over at Queen Square. And then they do a scan, and they come back with the results. It's a pituitary gland tumour. And that's why you're losing your peripheral vision. It's quite serious, but it's operable. In fact, they can deploy a robotic knife up your nostril and cut it away. And that doesn't sound very pleasant, a robotic knife cutting away part of your brain, so you're not so sure. So you get a second opinion. You ask one of your mates, how do I look? And they go, you look fine. Yeah, I feel fine, to be honest. I mean, that blurred vision thing last week, it seems to be a bit better this week. I think I'm fine. And so you've got two different opinions now. You've got the doctor's opinion saying you're very sick and you need surgery, and you've got your mate's opinion that you're fine. Right? And I just want to ask, what does the agnostic do at this point? What do you do? What's the neutral on the fence option? Actually, there isn't one, is there? Because you've either got to get surgery, or you're going to ignore the need for surgery. And you're going to gamble things on the doctor being wrong, or the doctor being right. But there's not a middle option. If there's a problem, if there's a sickness, if there's a treatment that you need, well, you're going to need the treatment. Or if the doctor's lying, then you want to, you know, get the doctor struck off. And I think those are the options with Jesus here. He's saying something is seriously wrong. He's also saying, I've got the solution to it. And there's not really a neutral way to respond to that. You know, you've either got to take the solution he offers, or you've got to ignore it and say he's lying. But you can't sort of do neither. So to summarize where we've got to, different ways of being agnostic. Agnostic because you've never checked. And please would you check? You know, just at least humour me and have a look. What was the evidence that convinced this guy John that his mate was life? It's at least worth finding out. What convinced him? Was he gullible? Was he right? Have a look. Agnostic because you can't know in principle. I think that's just a daft philosophical dead end. Agnostic because you don't want to know. You think Jesus would suck all of the joy out of your life. That's not the testimony of your Christian friend here. And look at their life and see, is it joyless and grey and awful? In which case, have a look. And ultimately, I suggest you don't need to be agnostic, because the answer to the most profound philosophical questions is a person in history that John met. And here's the account of it. But finally, it's not safe to be agnostic, because there's a problem and there's a solution on offer, but you've got to either take it or reject it. Hey, I'm really grateful for your attention. Thanks for letting me speak for so long. We're going to take a pause now. I'll hand back over to Ed, and then you're welcome to ask me anything you like. So thank you.
Great. Let me call us back together. We've got a lot of questions. Thank you for sending them in. Some really good questions here. Can we have them up on the screen, Angus? Is that possible?
With a bit of zooming in. There we go. Brilliant. Andrew, thank you very much. Here's the first question. It seems that the majority of your talk hinges on the claim that this gospel actually was written by John. However, a large number of scholars believe this is not the case. How do we know it was John?
Yeah, thank you. I think in a way I don't especially care. As a Christian, I do think it's by John, and I think there are some ultra sceptical scholars who think otherwise. I mean, everyone in the early church thought it was by John. So Irenaeus in the second century thought John's gospel was written by John, and he knew John. So I think that's, you know, that for me, that carries quite a lot of weight, that the people around at the time identified him with the Apostle John. But in a sense, you could be more sceptical. I don't think it would change the argument, because here is one of the documents that is the grounds of the early church, talking about the Jesus that they knew, that they followed, that they're willing to die for. And it's actually not the only document. So you could say, how do we know Matthew was written by Matthew? How do we know Mark was written by Mark? How do we know Luke was written by Luke? How do we know John was written by John? How do you know 1 Corinthians was written by Paul? And, you know, you could be sceptical, but at some point you're going to have to say, look, there's this movement explodes onto the scene in the first century with a load of Jewish people willing to die for the claim that their friend Jesus Christ was God, and they all think the same, and these are the documents that they look to. So I'd say that's sufficient grounds for me to say this is the place to look for what convinced them, what did they stand their ground on. And I don't think you have to answer all of those questions before you start having a look. It's a sort of question you could get more information on elsewhere. There's a guy in Cambridge called Pete Williams. He's an expert on these things. He's written a book called Can We Trust the Gospels, which I think is excellent. And there's all sorts of arguments in there. But again, I'm not sure you have to read all those arguments straight away. I would say start reading John. You know, it's the good principle of history, isn't it? You deal with the primary sources before you deal with the secondary critiques. So have a look at the source document. This is the first century document. See what you make of it. And then by all means, do some other reading if you want to, and that would be a help. I remember when I became a Christian, the minister of the church said, I wonder whether if you're not willing to accept that the things attributed to Jesus were said by Jesus, then you just have to find another unknown religious genius in the first century and you've doubled your problem, which I quite like that. Jesus said the things that have revolutionized the world and have been the foundation for an entire... And if it wasn't him, it was somebody else that we didn't know the name of, but he still said these things. So you might as well start there. So, yeah, I think there's good reason to get started and make progress with those questions. We can have a more in-depth debate, but that's really another talk. I'd say have a look, and if you're really worried, have a look at that Pete Williams book, Can We Trust the Gospels, which is excellent. I think it's Cambridge University Press. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Why do you think that other religions can't use the same argument? Is this talk just to debunk agnosticism or all religions other than Christianity?
So I'm a Christian, and I don't think other religions are true. I think they're mutually exclusive. They certainly can't all be true. One of the things I was taught at school was all religions are mutually true. And I think that was it was to promote tolerance and we're all right. But it was clearly nonsense. I mean, so... Hinduism says there's lots of gods. Christianity says there's one God. They're not both three. Or even more clearly, Islam says that Jesus was a prophet who did not die on the cross. Christianity says that Jesus is the Son of God who did die on a cross. Now, he either died on a cross or didn't die on a cross. I mean, historically, he certainly didn't do both. He didn't die and not die. So one of them is untrue. So they can't all be true. So what you need to do as an objective inquiry is to... look at them to see whether each is true. And by all means, read the Quran and examine it. I'm not trying to stop you doing that. Have a look at the Hindu scriptures and examine those. That's fine. One thing I would say is they're not making the same kind of claim as this at all. So Muhammad is saying, I met an angel on my own in a cave and he dictated to me the Quran. I mean, did he? If you're a Muslim, you think he did. I don't think he did. And how would you check? Because there's no one else there. There's no witnesses. There's just a man with a claim to revelation. Whereas with Jesus, there are eyewitnesses, touch witnesses, a whole bunch of people who claim that they saw him die and be raised from the dead. There's the miracles that he did and the trail that they left behind. The claim is he healed a man who was born blind next to a pool in Jerusalem called the Pool of Siloam, and there's people living in Jerusalem who know the Pool of Siloam. So it's a historical claim in a way that Buddhism, Hinduism, even Islam really aren't. They're just philosophies about the world. But this is a philosophy which is a person, and the person is attested to historically. So I don't think there's anything like that, actually, in other religions. So it isn't a category on its own. But, you know, if you look into Christianity and you decide it's not true, then by all means read the Quran, or read the Quran first if you want. But these are quite unique claims that we're looking at tonight.
Great. You've alluded in your answers already to the fact that there was a time when you weren't a Christian. So this next question is, were you previously an agnostic? How did you become a Christian?
I was an agnostic. I grew up in the UK. I went to church from when I was nine. The reason being that my piano teacher was in the church choir and suggested that I joined. So I was a choir boy until my voice broke. It was a very traditional kind of church, and I didn't believe it, really. So I just went through sort of traditions and so on. I didn't think it was actually true. And by the time I was in my late teens, I was becoming quite disillusioned by the church. I saw a lot of hypocrisy, and I thought people are just trying to look smart on a Sunday, but they're just the same as everyone else. I was also reading, I was about to go up to Cambridge to do natural sciences, and I was reading Richard Dawkins and other atheist stuff. So I was pretty confused. Certainly wasn't a Christian. What changed it was, in my first year, I met some Christians who didn't fit my stereotype of Christians. So they weren't gullible. That sounds rude. But I thought Christians just, you know, they believe stupid things like fairies. These Christians were very, you know, intelligent people, and they were thought through. And they weren't hypocrites. I'd always thought that was all there was to it. I read the scandals in the papers, but I saw people who had real integrity, and they were intelligent, and they were Christian. Now, that didn't make it true, obviously, but it meant it was less dismissible. I was like, what is it about them? And I think through them, I heard the Christian message for the first time. And I think I realized for the first time that it was an objective message. So it wasn't like, you know, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? And I could say the best flavor of ice cream is Fraggola. What do you think the best flavor of ice cream is?
Salted caramel.
You're wrong. It's actually Fraggola, right? Now, you know, this is, for me, it's Fraggola. For him, it's salted caramel. I just thought, for me, I'm an atheist. For you, you're a Christian. But I realised if this is something that happened or didn't happen, it's objective. So when was the Battle of Hastings? 1066. It's one of the only dates I remember from history at school. But if you said it was in 1266, you're wrong. And if you went back in the time machine to 1266, there wouldn't be Norman Bates landing in Kent. But if you went back to 1066, there were. Because historical things either happened or didn't happen. And I just wanted to know, well, is there a God that made the world or not? And is there a Jesus Christ who opened a blind man's eyes or not? And did he rise from the dead or not? And is this true or not? And it's not just, is it true for me, but is it true for everyone, or is it false for everyone? And it might be that it's true and I'm wrong, or it might be that it's false and Christians are wrong, but it's one or the other. And I just really wanted to know, and I started to read into it, and for the first time I actually engaged with some of the evidence. And then I got scared and I thought, I don't want this to be true. This is, you know, there's got massive implications. If there's a God that runs the world and I'm basically living as though I just could do whatever I want, that's pretty intimidating. And then I tried to hide from it for a while. So I kind of was quite intellectually dishonest, actually. I just avoided the question for several months. And in the end, you know, I think God was very patient with me. And I, sorry, this is a long story. But the other side to it was, in parallel with examining Christianity, when I dared to, I tried to examine my own current belief. And I think that's quite important, because it's you can always endlessly find fault with another view. But like, what is your own view? And it was like I never examined the ground that I was standing on. And in the end, what really shook me was realizing how absolutely fragile my atheism was. You know, I think I'm here entirely by chance. I cannot explain why anything I do today matters. Because in the end, the heat death of the universe, and that's it. And I have no reason at all to trust what I think, because if my brain is just a random collection of atoms and it's only here to survive to propagate my DNA, why should I believe the things that the electrons say? Like, they're not going to access truth. And so I realised that even rationality was grounded on something that I couldn't explain. And basically my whole atheistic worldview was collapsing. And at the same time, I was looking at this person, Jesus, who was attractive but scary. And in the end, I realised he was worth following.
Brilliant. Next question, where has it gone? Here we go. There was a question here, a former Christian, asking about why God created us in the first place. If it's okay with you, I'm just going to say very quickly, if that is your question, come on our weekend away. We've got a weekend away on the topic of providence coming up in a month's time, and we are going to be addressing that very question. So do come and join us. If you really can't, the talks will be recorded. They'll be on our website afterwards.
Did you plant that question just so you could
get that? No, it would have been brilliant. It would have been genius, but I didn't even think of that. Great. We'll spend our time, though, tackling some of these other questions. The next one, I think, is why should we believe in John? What makes him credible? Surely anyone could write fake stories. Is there anything more you want to add on that?
Yeah, I've said a little bit about that already. I can say more. So what I said in the talk was, people give their life for causes that are not true all the time. People don't give their life for causes that they know not to be true. So I don't think it makes sense to be a fictional writer and then to suffer. It makes sense to be a fictional writer and then profit. So you may know the religion Scientology that occasionally has exhibits in London, and it's has some famous advocates like Tom Cruise and so on. And the guy, Ron Hubbard, who founded it, says, if you want to be rich, found a religion. And then he did, and he's quite rich. So I can see why you'd make that up, but I can't see why you'd make something up and then it costs you and you're threatened and you lose everything, but you still hold on to it. Whereas if you saw someone come back from the dead, I can understand how rationally you would face martyrdom. It just makes sense, doesn't it? Like, we'll kill you unless you recant. Well, you could kill me, but I know that I'll come back from the dead. How do you know that? Well, because I saw someone come back from the dead, so I'm ready. I didn't mean that flippantly. I mean, it's not nice to be executed for your faith, but it makes sense that somebody sure about this would be willingly martyred, whereas it doesn't make sense to me that someone who made this up would be willingly martyred. That's the first answer. There's lots of other things I could say, though. Fiction doesn't exist in the first century. This is a point made by C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Narnia stories. He was professor of medieval literature in Oxford and Cambridge in succession. And he just says, look, realistic fiction isn't invented for another 1,000 years in literature. So, I mean, you have Greek myths, which are sort of fables, but you don't have books like John, which say, this is what happened, this is who it happened to, this happened next, these characters then did this. You know, it's not written as fiction. Or another example would be, another answer would be, it just, if you wanted to make up a story, you couldn't get away with this kind of story, because John, and in fact the other gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, they all name places and people within the same few years of when they published their accounts. So, you know, I suggest it's a very risky thing to do. So if I want to make up a story, I start long, long ago, far, far away, and make sure all of the characters are untraceable. But you don't say, oh, it happened in Capernaum, and the guy whose daughter was raised from the dead was the synagogue ruler, and his name was Jairus, because you just go and check. You know, this is an actual place. People can go there. They can find Jairus. They can say what happened. Or, you know, they can find Jairus's children, or, you know. But it sort of makes itself checkable. And this thing's happened in Jerusalem. It was the capital city. At the Passover, it was the major festival when everyone was there. And it happened in public. So, in fact, when the Christian message is first proclaimed after Jesus' death and resurrection, the first preacher, Peter, he says, Jesus of Nazareth was a man who did many miracles, wonders and signs, as you yourselves know. He's just appealing to the crowd saying, look, this is common knowledge. Now, you can't do that if you're introducing for the first time a fairy story. You can't name the places and the people that are checkable. So in all those ways, I'd say you should take it seriously.
Brilliant. Next question here. How do you convince an agnostic that they need saving? Building on the medical analogy, what if the individual doesn't even feel like there is a need to see a doctor?
I don't know if you can, to be honest. In comfortable, prosperous 21st century Britain. Because for a while, anyway, and most of you are quite young, your lives could be so easy that it's not necessary to examine what's true. I don't think that will always be the case. So I'm not saying this just to raise the emotional temperature, but last week my sister's partner, he's my age, mid-40s, she just became suddenly acutely ill and was in intensive care. And then by Wednesday she was on a ventilator. And then by Wednesday night she was getting worse. And I genuinely thought last week she was going to die. And wonderfully, I can say this story now because amazingly, over the weekend she really made a recovery and she's now breathing on her own and she took her first few steps today. But, you know, my family is mainly not Christians. But when something like that happens, you suddenly want to know what's true. I'm not saying Christianity is true because it gets you out of a crisis, but I am saying when there's a crisis, you will care whether it's true or not. It's not enough just as a sticking plaster. But a claim about life after death matters when you face death. A claim about the defeat of evil matters when you face evil. It's why in Ukraine right now, I doubt there's many people who are indifferent to these questions because they really care, is there going to be an end to evil or not? So, yeah, maybe it's the luxury of your life right now that things are so easy that you don't care. And I don't think that will last. I think there'll be a time that you really care about these things.
Great. I think for the sake of time, we'll make this our last question, if that's all right. What would you say to someone who has read the entire Bible but is still agnostic because the Bible isn't enough scientific evidence and they've never experienced God like, quote, those Christians?
If that's someone here, I'd love to meet you because I think that's a good effort if you've read the whole thing and it'd be nice to talk to you about it. If this is a theoretical person, I don't know, have they? I'm always a bit suspicious. I've read the whole Bible, like, really? But if you really have, then come and talk to me. I think I'm optimistic about it because I think there's a God, and I think the God who made the world isn't hiding. He wants to be known by those who seek for him. Now, I suppose it depends. You know, if you read the whole Bible just in a sort of fault-finding way, I'm just going to read it to find reasons to reject it. Maybe you could be perverse like that. But if you read it and said, Lord, I really want to know what's true, please show me, I think he will. So I'm very optimistic about that. I challenge the idea that there's no scientific evidence, because I think, on the contrary, the Bible is full of that kind of evidence. So things, you know, lab results that people have seen and reported. I did a PhD in neuroscience years ago, and I didn't do all the experiments myself. I routinely read about experiments in journals that other people said they did, and I believed them. So, you know, there's a bit of data. It's their data point. I'm basing things on it. That's what science does all the time, and it's just what we're doing now. Here's some data points. Somebody else did them, and we should incorporate them into our theory. But it's a good analogy, isn't it? Like, what if you've got a theory that says, my hypothesis is there is no God, we're here by chance and the universe is only material. The data point is a lot of people saw somebody rise from the dead. It doesn't really fit the theory, to be honest. So that data point means that the hypothesis has to be rejected. There is a God, and otherwise this couldn't have happened. Now, I think that seems to me, that's the standard scientific method. Hypothesis contradicted by the evidence, change hypothesis. But it kind of irritates me that some atheists want to do the thing like this. There's no God. Here's some evidence that someone rose from the dead. It can't have happened because there's no God. Yeah, but here's the evidence. No, but it didn't happen. That's just like, you can't erase the data point because you're unwilling to revise your theory. That's really not scientific. So I'd say that the normal scientific method will be enough to move you towards the Christian answer, if these things are real.
Andy, thank you very much. We'll stop there because of time.